Welkom bij de SEOcast in samenwerking met de SEO Brein Community. Ik ben Jeroen Stikkelorum, een community builder.
Ik ben Martijn Hoving.
Ik ben Dennis Akkerman.
En vandaag en morgen gaan we jou het verhaal van Brighton SEO naar thuis brengen.
Veel luisterplezier.
Brighton SEO in de afternoon, Dennis. En next to us is Pedro Diaz.
Yeah.
Welkom.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you for the invite.
How did you become an SEO?
Oh, well, I did a bit of an unusual path in SEO because I started from the search engine.
Okay.
And then I became an SEO.
So you worked at Google?
Yeah.
Ah.
I worked at Google for 5.5 years.
You know the magic.
I know, you know, Philly Wizzy is a Dutch SEO.
He's also ex-Google.
Yeah, he worked with me back then.
Okay.
At Google. We were part of the spam fighting team, you know, all this stuff. Yeah. So before that, I had some kind of, you know, SEO kind of nuances. I played with Alta Vista back in the time when Alta Vista was a thing before Google came. So that's where my kind of path in search started. My path in SEO started after I left Google. So kind of.
I still have an NDA of Google. Of can well, you tell
I think
us everything
I think,
about.
I think I have an NDA. A lot of stuff that never expires, and I would never talk about the certain things. So, but I'm fairly free to talk about. I think even if I would mention a lot of things, they have evolved. You know, things in Google evolve. Like I think, like after 1 or 2 years I left, things were not anymore in the state that when I left them.
Oh.
So. It's safe to assume that even if I would kind of talk about weird tools and what they did, one, it would not be useful for anyone because it would not give you any... It could give you any insights in Google's interests, but it would not give you any kind of actionable things to do nowadays. I think the best thing that I learned from Google is to think like a search engineer.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing never expires because you know where Google heads, you know... what a retrieval system is, you know, what a bot is, what the bot limitations are, how it operates. And I think that's the North Star. As long as you know that, you're safe, I believe.
And it's an advantage to work first at Google and then manipulate Google?
I think it helps you with being... it certainly helps being, like, your appeal as a... You know, a lot of people will want to work with you and hire you.
Yeah.
But as the Google mojo kind of fades away, you have to make your own expertise in your name. So, like I said, I think yes, it gave me you can call it an unfair advantage over anyone that didn't have it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was unfair because I did 6 rounds of interviews to go to Google. So it was quite intense, but I think it was it's rewarding because it put me in a path, in a way of thinking that I would never. The principles that I operate myself as a consultant, the kind of advice that I give, is always to make people try to understand the system rather than to teach them like the tricks of, you know, shortcuts or anything. I think it's more rewarding if you try to understand how a clock works by looking at the gears than, you know, trying to understand, like, if you can do any shortcut to, you know, increase or decrease, you know, or the time. So, yeah.
And after that, you became an SEO consultant, mainly for large e-commerce? Or?
Yeah, so after I left Google, being a Portuguese... I'm Portuguese native from Portugal.
Yeah.
And one of my roles at Google was to communicate with the Portuguese language market.
Yeah.
Because I used to do spam fighting in the Portuguese language market. You want to communicate with people and tell them why Google doesn't like certain things in terms of manipulation and spam.
Yeah.
So Google would send me often to Brazil and, you know, mostly to Brazil because it's the largest market, to be honest. Portugal is tiny. And so I got to be known in Brazil quite early and go to speak at conferences. So once I left Google, kind of I let a lot of people that wanted to seek my advice and talk with me. I don't know if they were hoping that I give them any secrets, but I know. I think I only gave them good advice. I worked with a lot of the largest e-commerces in Brazil.
Yeah.
They were like the Amazon equivalents, but for Brazil. So I'm fortunate to have worked with almost all of them.
Yeah.
And even lately, like just last year, I consulted for 2 years with the largest e-commerce and secondhand market like platform in Latin America, which is Mercado Libre.
Yeah.
They are like as big as eBay or bigger than even Amazon.
Yeah.
They outcompete Amazon in Latin America.
What are the differences in the Brazilian market in comparison with the US, for instance?
Well, differences.
More focus on mobile because people don't have desktops?
Yeah, that's one thing. There are a lot of people that have poor internet connections in rural areas of Brazil. So you have to be really aware and build your tech stack, or your platform, your app, whatever you operate with, to be able to cater the widest range of devices. So one of the things that Mercado Libre, for example, focused a lot, and they were praised over their competitors for it, was how fast their website was, and then how efficient their delivery system is, even faster than Amazon in Brazil.
Yeah.
So even in remote areas of Brazil, you'll get like your package delivered like in sometimes in the same day, kind of, which is crazy. So this is one of the things. And then, like, I don't know, because Brazil is so poor in some aspects, in some areas, like, people have less mobility in terms of public transportation, so they tend to be more local.
Yeah.
So they will search for, you know, I want to buy a car, but I don't want to go out of my city or even my state. I want to search for a car in my state.
Hyper-local queries.
Yeah, hyper-local, so that kind of is a nuance to the market.
Yeah.
And then people are very kind of keen on deals, so if you don't like offer them discounts or do this kind of, you'll face kind of a resistance where people will always wait for this kind of Black Fridays. It's in their culture, the bargaining and discount culture. So that's another thing.
Nice. Really interesting. So what triggered me a bit was during your introduction, you said like, Google gave me that I can think of a search engineer.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes me question like, how does a search engineer think?
Yeah.
Can you maybe share that with us?
So, because people usually think about search as a monolithic thing, like that there are websites, Google crawls my website, and then Google ranks my website and serves it. But actually, there's a lot of intricacies in between. That if you understand them, you will, as you work within SEO, you will understand why things fail sometimes and the way they fail, or why you need to kind of deliver your website to Google in a certain way. For example, a lot of people don't do a very good job with XML sitemaps. They just do a one XML site, a giant XML sitemap, and they serve it to Google. When you probably should be thinking about slicing it in thinner and more segmented, and as the larger is the website, even more prevalent is this advice. So Google has like there are a lot of things that happen, so you need to understand Google has a crawling process. What does the crawling process entail? It entails that Google has a scheduler. The scheduler schedules time to visit websites, goes out, visits websites. And what does that entail? It entails that Google doesn't have infinite amount of time to scroll websites. So you have to make the most of the time that Google, when it reaches your website. And then how does Google decide to crawl a website and not the other? It's like if your website doesn't get searched by the brand, it's probably one sign because Google doesn't see appeal on your brand, or even the links to your website can go to back to the basics, right? Like links are matter because they are an indicator of importance. Mm-hmm. That's one of the earliest blocks of why Google existed. They built their index based on links, hyperlinks, and how links point to links as an endorsement of.
Yeah.
And so, and then they would build like what the, so Google has to decide how to crawl the web. Where do you start? You have to start with sites that you trust, and then go from there and follow the links from these sites to others. And this is how you kind of build the reputation over the web. So you, in certain aspect, build like a layer of what you say the God sites, so to speak. Yeah. And then you use this as your pathway to the web. So, yeah. And then you think like, okay, now I understand a little bit how the indexing system works. Let's go, I mean, the crawling system works. Let's go to the indexing. No, what does this mean? Google wants to be efficient, so Google doesn't want to waste time crawling twice the same thing. So a lot of people had the misconception, oh, if you have duplicate content on your website, Google's going to penalize you. Well, yes and no, because what is a penalty? It's just because Google doesn't crawl you, or Google demotes your result, it doesn't mean that it's penalizing you. It's just, you know, not preferring your result over some other.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you have a penalty and you have to do something about it. It's, well, you need to do something about it, but it's not in the sense of, like, I have to get rid of this penalty. It's like,
yeah,
I have to improve my architecture.
Of,
yes,
penalty.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are a lot of things that, and then comes the process of, after the indexing comes the process of rendering.
Yeah.
Google needs to render whatever is not visible through JavaScript. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of websites that rely on JavaScript to have
too much.
Yeah. And then comes the process of ranking and then serving. And during the process of ranking, a lot of things happen. Google has algorithms that kind of boost or push down results. And then that's where also penalties got in placed. Google doesn't have any penalized websites in the index. Penalties are applied at serving time.
Yeah.
So if your website is like penalizing Google for some reason, Google will always get it from the index first, but then will not serve it or will kind of demote it after serving.
Yeah.
So once you understand all of this cadence, and all, it kind of helps you understand why something must have happened on a website through its process and why you are seeing certain fluctuations in traffic or not. So I think that's one of the things that helps me understand, and I keep reading nowadays even like about retrieval systems, because I think it's very important to understand those, mostly in the age of AIs and how data is ingested to train, and because AIs use two types of information retrieval. They use information retrieval to get data for the training corpus, and they use information retrieval to do the retrieval augmented generation, which is the process of grounding the result once the response is generated. Mm-hmm. So that's another bot that kind of retrieves.
But so it's an entire
ecosystem.
Another system of not comparable with how Google works, right?
Yeah, it is. It is, basically.
And I think we are all figuring this out with log files and all those kind of stuff. But you have to start over again, because at Google you had the knowledge how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all in the market have that.
Yeah.
But the LLM training is just another game. Or is it the same game?
It's a different game in the way it caters your intent.
Yeah.
Pretty much like, I don't know, if you remember when we had blogs and then social came along.
Yeah.
And then blogs died because of social.
Yeah.
And it's because like the way we consume information and our needs kind of were better met by social. But it didn't kill search, didn't kill the need for search. And I think to certain
aspects... Spam will never die.
and I think because before with Google, we learned that we can do most of 90% of our things with search. Like we wanted to find places to eat, things to buy, friends to chat with. All the intentions were there in search because there was the index. But once these standalone services started coming and placed themselves in their spots, they took a little bit of a slice from search. You can even say that nowadays, like Amazon, for example, 30% of the searches that have a purchase intent start in Amazon and not in Google anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a little bit of another slice that was stolen from
hotels and flights.
Yeah, exactly.
And, all those
so you can say that with LLMs and AI, we have this other slice, yet another slice of human need for information that we used to use search to get it, but now we have a better mechanism to do to get it. Does it kill search? I don't think so.
No.
But we will have this system that now, for example, I think it's a better illustration if I give an example. Like before, you have a problem in your TV, for example, and you have like a TV connected to a weird system that nobody has in the world, right? If you have an issue with your system, you can probably find information about your TV and your system separately in search, but not the two together, because if it's a very unique conversation. But now with AI, the AI has the capacity of, you know, checking and learning from similar problems to yours that are not necessarily with the same system of the of devices, and then understanding in a dumb way of artificial intelligence the technical aspects of your two systems, and then applying this knowledge in generating something that's unique to you that doesn't exist anywhere else. And so I think this is where LLMs are very powerful, because they create, they fill your unique need for a very specific and very granular thing.
I fixed that, a lot of that, problems at home with
that you didn't have before. Like, now you can even take a photo of something and say, help me fix this or learn this remote control.
Yeah.
And it will tell you how that works. You know, but so that's, but then if you think about, okay, I understand that the process of how it works, but what's the process of it, how it gathers information to become intelligent? It needs a crawler.
It needs
an information retrieval system, and that's what SEOs work with, because we work with crawlers, and crawlers have their own limitations, which they still have nowadays. And then there are several types of crawlers that we were used to the crawlers that were the classic crawlers that just go and harvest and collect information, but now we also have the crawlers that go and do stuff on behalf of users.
Yeah.
The so-called user-triggered crawlers, which are agents.
Yeah.
So you ask your AI to do something for you. It can ground an answer and kind of generate this answer for you because it fetches the information from a website, so to give you up-to-date information.
Yeah.
But it also can kind of, you know, go do a task for, you know, on your behalf. So this is another kind of crawler, of bot, that will have its own limitations and will have to deal with servers and APIs and CDNs, and whatever the principles we have as SEO are still true for these mechanisms.
I also thought about this, because we tend to focus on Google, on e-commerce, large e-commerce, on filtering, right?
Yeah.
Filters are the basic...
faceted navigation.
Yeah, way of searching within a product listing.
Uh-huh.
But right now, the agent, it doesn't apply the filter. It's just the P2P with a lot of stuff on it that he makes the decision about.
Yeah.
So we have to optimize for bots instead of optimize for the user.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and optimizing for the bots, I see it as understanding what does the bot need to do and make sure that it doesn't have any roadblocks in its path. Because, for example, we have a lot of user-triggered agents nowadays that... You could say there have been several conversations about if these agents obey robots.txt or not.
Yeah.
And some of them do not, but some of them do. And I've seen in cases where, for example, Grok obeys robots.txt. And what this means is that, for example, if you have a website like eBay or Amazon that has a search field where you would classically would block search from classical bots, but now you want the user-triggered bot to be able to do a search.
Yeah.
So if you block the search from bots, it means that the user-triggered bot will not be able to use the search because it will be blocked. So in a sense, one of the things that I usually do,
accessible, right?
I usually unblock filters and search for user-triggered bots, but I keep it blocked for classic bots because you do not want index stuff randomly, because someone searched for some random stuff in a search field. So, but those are the distinctive ways to understand how these two mechanisms operate, and how you open or close the doors for them in different ways.
Nice.
So I've a question. So you told a bit about some of the clients that you worked for in LATAM. Really big sites, millions, maybe even billions of URLs.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do SEO or AI SEO for sites that have such scale?
You have to think about scale. You cannot go like, and so this title has the wrong keyword on it.
No, yeah. No?
So what you usually do is like, you'll have to have some kind of, or you have to set your weight to have some kind of data collection in place that starts to harvest data and collect data in BigQuery or in Amazon Athena or some these other systems that have that you can then use SQL language then to query results at scale. I was talking with Martino just now, I consulted with eBay for quite a while. eBay is one of the websites that I've seen that they have been collecting data since the 90s, and they have like a trove of log files from Google, from everything, and they can do comparison. Like, if they want to do comparison, like what happened 20 years ago, they can, because they have this historical data.
It's really nice. And they have a large data center to tell the story, right?
Yeah, from log access files to queries to Google Console, Search Console data dumped into SQL.
Yeah.
And then you can use in-house build software to overlay data. I want to overlay, crawl data from log access on top of Google Search Console data, and then I can add like Google Analytics data even on top of it and paint like a really complete scenario. So if you want to do something at scale, this is how you have to think first about data collection and what each data collection layer is gonna indicate towards a decision that you need to make, right? So for example, nowadays people are talking about looking at log files because of LLMs, but that comes from a need that LLMs are opaque and nobody is giving you, what are the people searching in this LLM? You can only guess.
Yeah.
And the best place to guess is look at your log files and see what are the bot hits from these LLMs on my URLs.
Yeah.
What is it trying to guess any URLs that I do not have? Or is it hitting the URLs I do have? And then looking at this at scale, because looking at this on a very granular or daily basis means nothing, but trying to look for patterns, it's what is going to open your insights. It's going to, everything is at scale is about patterns and looking at patterns.
Right. Last question.
Ready?
What is your largest SEO fuck up in the past?
Largest SEO
not
fuck up.
Not at Google, but after.
Largest SEO fuck up. Well, I don't know. I tried not to have any fuck ups, but I think my
should prepare you for this question.
I think it's mostly from a business perspective. You know, when you leave Google or a place like Google, your mindset is towards very much like doing the right things and the things properly instead of doing it dirty and then fixing it later.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that I kind of painfully learned was that I wanted to do the right things and properly right out of the bat with a lot of clients, and I met a lot of friction because of that.
Yeah.
Where you should have gone with like a, let's do it dirty and an MVP and start with the minimum and then we can, scale it up. So that's one of fuck up in terms of myself, because I kind of, I didn't have this knowledge, and I learned by doing it.
Yeah.
I never put like a no index on a website or anything. But I worked with clients that did, and hopefully I logged in on a weekend and I caught that, and I called them over the weekend saying, "Oh, you put you launched your website on Saturday, and you put like a no index or a disallowed on blocks on robots, and go and put your team on."
They really like that call, right?
They do.
Because otherwise they drop.
Yeah.
That's a nice learning, starting with an MVP.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people want, a lot of SEOs want, have this mindset that they want always the ideal world or everything is clean and nicely optimized, but the process to get there often is dirty and, and bumpy, and you have to learn with that, because if you are going to, you know, pitch the ideal world to every client, they're going to say, oh, this is very expensive to get, or this is very a lot of work to do, and you are going to overwhelm them, or either with costs or with, like, suck all their resources into building something, and that's not a it's not a good place to be.
All right, thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, thank you for having me.
It was fun at Brighton SEO.
Yeah, right. It was a pleasure.